Welcome to 2,730 Years and Counting. The interviewer and the guest may not always share the same opinion, but we are all looking for the truth. Please join us.
The hand of Yahweh came upon me, and he took me far away to a valley. He said, "You must prophesy, O Son of Man. You must speak to the wind." So I prophesied as he commanded me. This is what I did say. They came to life and they stood to their feet. A mighty army, too big to number, so exceedingly great. And he explained to me, what is the mystery? This is the house of Israel. Though they say they are cut off, though they say they don't belong, though all their hope has been lost, and they've forgotten who they are.
Great to see those of you who are early comers coming early. We've got to get Bruce back to Florida or New York?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. In time to get to Israel. So we need to get on with this. The gentleman I'm going to introduce to you tonight is a good friend that I managed to meet back in 2010 on my first trip to Israel. And he was the tour guide on both of the bus tours that I took, down into southern Israel and up into northern Israel. And he was incredibly entertaining and incredibly knowledgeable. And then when I started my podcast, when it was a radio show, I invited him to come on as a guest for an interview. And we've been friends ever since, I think. And I think that's really a wonderful thing. And he's got some things to tell you tonight that are going to raise your eyebrows a bit. You know, he's not out to make a villain out of anybody, but he's out to demonstrate what has taken place and that we need to know about. So with that being said, I'm going to get out of his way because you see me every day, even when you don't want to see me. So I'll get out of your way and we'll get on with it. I just want you to know that the Bruce Brill, who's our speaker tonight, is an amazing guy. He aliyahed to Israel 40 years ago plus. I forget exactly how many years it was, but a long time ago. And when he was in America, he was a member of the NSA. Do you all know what the NSA is? The National Security Agency. Serious American intelligence. or you might not want to say intelligence, but yeah. Anyway, but he knew that the Yom Kippur War was getting ready to happen 10 days before, I think it was 10 days, before Israel knew it was happening. Israel had no idea when they were attacked. And they had almost 3,000 of their troops killed because they weren't ready. And so he's going to talk about how that took place and what he experienced. It's rather amazing. Plus, he's got a whole lot of great things to tell you about Israel that you probably have never thought about. But anyway, he's a fun guy to listen to. I'm going to get out of his way. Once again, his name is Bruce Brill. Good day, Bruce.
Perhaps a little bit of background about myself. Both my parents were Jewish. My mother's maiden name was Levin, meaning that she came from the tribe of Levites. And my father came from the house of David. And I won't go into detail about my genealogy. You didn't come here to hear that. But what you did come to hear is a little bit about myself, and then a lot of bit about the Yom Kippur War, October 6th, 1973. And then we could talk about what follows October 6th, October 7th. So both my parents are Jewish, but they were not religious at all. And so I grew up in a house where we knew about the Jewish holidays, and we'd go to temple or synagogue maybe a couple few times a year. But we didn't keep kosher at home. I grew up eating probably more ham, bacon, shrimp, clams, and lobsters than many of you. So I began reading the Bible, and I understood from reading the first five books of that Bible that there was definitely an interface between God in heaven and this people called the Hebrews, and that there was a serious interaction and speaking and instructions and commandments. And I began keeping kosher when I was teaching school after college. And when was that? That was 1969, 1970, and something else happened in 1970. That's when the draft lottery was instituted, and lucky me, my number came up, number 51. And I knew I would be tapped on the shoulder and investigated different possibilities. One possibility, and some of my friends or relatives took advantage of this first possibility, run away, go to Canada. Not a problem. Another possibility is allow Uncle Sam to draft you. Then you only serve 2 years. Probably you'll be sent to the jungles of Vietnam and probably come home, but your chances of not coming home are also significant. Or you could take a battery of tests, find out what you're good at, and maybe hone in on a job that will keep you away from the jungles of Vietnam. And that's what I did. And I aced the language aptitude test. It was called the ALAT. In the U.S. Army, every other word is an acronym. ALAT, Army Language Aptitude Test. And I aced it. I didn't get a good mark. I aced it. And they said, whoa. I also said, whoa. Because they were what in Israel they call Mivchan Amerikai, which means an American test. What does that mean? Multiple choice. That's known as an American test. And I was lucky. I think I was lucky. Maybe I had a little bit of talent in languages. But anyway, they said...
Or help from above.
Or maybe God wanted me to be in a certain place at a certain time. This is also not only possible, it's probable. So anyway, they gave me language of your choice. What would you like? Chinese, Vietnamese, Laotian, Cambodian, Arabic? Arabic, thank you, I'll take Arabic. And I was sent after basic training in what was called Fort Meade in New Jersey, where my dad went through basic when it was called Camp Meade. Did I say Meade? Dix. Fort Dix and Camp Dix. So it was called Camp Dix during World War II. And when I went in, already it became a fort. After basic training, off to California in the Presidio of Monterey, which belonged to a fort that doesn't exist anymore, Fort Ord. The Presidio of Monterey still does exist, however. And that's where Dillywick was. Is that English? Another acronym, Defense Language Institute West Coast. So, 47 weeks of Arabic language training with native Arab teachers. And you get to know the Arab mind and the Arab mentality. And they teach you. Part of the course was not just language, but culture, mentality, behavior. And you learn the Arab mind after 47 weeks of sitting in class for 6 hours a day. Then after that, some weeks of security training in Goodfellow Air Force Base, San Angelo, Texas. And then off to your permanent duty station, which in my case was Fort Meade. But the best student in our Arabic class, who's a Coloradan, and I want to show you a picture of him, so I'll quickly go through these photographs until we get to Merwan. Okay. The draft dodger rag, I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember it, but that was kind of a way of putting a smile on Americans' faces because of a bad situation. Okay, this is what I was telling you about. This is your induction notice, your draft card. And my dad also served in the Army in World War II. And what I would like to bring your attention to is how Uncle Sam generally cares about the Jewish serviceman. You'll see here in his dog tag, right here, there's an H. Gene, can I make this full screen and then advance? Ta-da! So now the folks in the back can see, thank you, can see the, where's the cursor? Okay, so I can, there's no baton. If you see here, it says H, stands for Hebrew. But when he was sent into combat in Europe against the Germans, they gave him an alternative set of dog tags with a P in the second set, which means he's Protestant, in case he fell captive. So Uncle Sam cared about his Jewish servicemen. Selective service, induction notice, and orders to report for duty and to try and get out to get a deferment. The employer of my school district, I was teaching at the time, wrote a letter how essential I am for the schooling of the junior high school kids that I was teaching. The Army Security Agency said, we'll be happy to take him. And the Army Security Agency, you'll hear a little bit more about in a moment. Orders to report. There's your official orders. It's not so interesting. Fort Dix, basic training. Then the Presidio of Monterey. It was a mixed service base. And just briefly, you see these barracks. They were built temporarily during World War II. We were using them in 1971 when I went in. Here's his Coloradan. He was the best student in our class. He was so talented in languages. He was trying to learn Spanish and decided that he would take a trip to Mexico to immerse himself in the language. He ran out of money in Mexico City and decided that, he didn't decide initially, he heard about a program in Cuba. Work half day on a commune and learn Spanish half day. And it was free. And so he walked into the Cuban embassy in Mexico City to get some information on this program. And in the end, he didn't go, and he went home. Okay, during his BI, another acronym, background investigation, before you're given your security clearance, he was asked if he ever had contact with any communist officials. And he knew he walked into the Cuban embassy in Mexico City. He knew that, but he didn't want to make problems for himself, and it was just very brief, and he felt it would cause more trouble to say I walked into the Cuban embassy, and so he said no. They knew that he walked into the Cuban embassy in Mexico City. American security is so good. Thank God. Thank God. It's so good. But they went a little bit overboard. The best student in the class did not get his security clearance, and he was not sent to security training in Texas with the rest of us. He was sent to Fort Huachuca. That's about as close as you can get to Mexico and still be in the U.S. Army. They called it the hole, and they had jokes about it that he told me, that they said you can never go AWOL, because you can still be seen 2 days from the time you left. Anyway, that's Larry Merwin. And because his last name was Merwin, he was given the Arabic name in Arabic language school, Merwan. And my name was Bessem. And my Arabic friends today, they call me Bessem because I introduce myself to them in their language. And I'm Bessem. So graduated from, that made it worse. Graduated from Arabic language school and then sent to Goodfellow Air Force Base, where no cameras or photography is allowed. Yes, I was a naughty boy, but I didn't take the photograph. Can't blame me for taking the photograph. And then sent to NSA. NSA was then multiple times larger than the CIA. But nobody heard of NSA back then. Very, very few people heard of it, even though it was so much bigger than the CIA. And we used to joke that NSA stood for no such agency. And it's huge. Back then it's huge. Today it's even huger. This hippie was the head of the Hebrew division at NSA. And let me tell you what my job was at NSA. Initially, as an Arabic intelligence analyst, I was doing a job that required maybe 20 minutes, maximum a half hour. I can't tell you exactly what I did, but that's all that was required. At the time, it wasn't war time. When the war broke out, I was working 16 hours a day. But at the time, my big job was to look busy for the remaining 8.5 hours I was there at my desk. That was the hardest part. And what I did was, besides reading books, I devoured book after book. I began learning Hebrew, which jokingly, back in the 60s, before I came on board at NSA, was called Special Arabic, because it's not nice to spy on your friends. And Israel was a friend. So how could you be spying on a Hebrew-speaking country? And the nice-looking blonde next to him was my sister. So I began learning Hebrew, and the head of the Hebrew department, this hippie, was looking for a roommate. I thought, wow, bingo, what could be better for me? To move in with the best Hebrew linguist on the block. And so he became my roommate, he became my friend, he became almost family, and really almost family, because he and my sister were getting serious at one point. This book I wrote about the Yom Kippur War, and that, now I'll get on to that. So here I am working as an Arabic intelligence analyst, hardly using my language that I learned for 47 weeks, hardly using it. You don't use it, you lose it. And at the same time, I was getting treatment on a neck problem that I had. Occasionally, once every couple few weeks, I had treatment at the clinic in NSA. And this particular time, on October 4th, a Thursday, I wanted to go home because that was the Yom Kippur weekend. This is 1973. And so I smartly, shrewdly, that same naughty boy that climbed the fence next to the no photography sign, I arranged a clinic appointment at 2 o'clock in the afternoon that Thursday. So after my appointment, I would take off and get home. Home was Long Island, New York. And Fort Meade, NSA in Fort Meade, is in Maryland. It was about a 4.5 hour drive. I know to you Westerners, that's nothing. But you don't have the Baltimore tunnel to deal with during rush hour. So I thought this was a great idea. I'll arrange this appointment, and at about 2:30, I'll take off and beat the rush hour through the tunnel. I get called down to the clinic. The nurse comes over to me, Specialist Brill. You have a phone call at the desk. I go to the desk. I pick up a black phone. The color is important. And it's my immediate supervisor. You're planning on going home this weekend after your appointment. I said, yeah. He said, don't even think about going home. This weekend, we have a war on our hands, and the blank hits the fan on Saturday. Remember now, this is Thursday. And remember, this is between 2 and 2:30, and he knew before me. And who knew before him who informed him? So I said, his name, I can't tell you his full name because the Pentagon refused me to divulge full names of workers. But his first name was Mike. I said, Mike, you got to be kidding. We've had several alerts earlier the same year where it looked like there was Arab military movement that could suggest an attack was imminent. But they never happened. So I said, surely this is another false alarm. And he said, no, this time it's for real. And I said, it's hard to believe, because you get so used to laughing at Sadat. Back in 1971 and 1972, he said, this is the year of decision, when Egypt was going to attack Israel. And each year came and each year went, and there was no year of decision. So this was 1973. Add that to the years of decision, that nothing happened. So I said, again, this is a joke. He said, no, this time it's definite. This time it's aval. That's an expression used in the agency that means there's no doubt. The first day of the war, because I had been learning Hebrew and I could gist Hebrew as well as Arabic, I got a special job to monitor live communication from the battlefront on the first day of the war. And I pick up an Israeli soldier on the front line. And again, I can't go into detail about what I heard. What I heard is behind what was redacted here, that the Pentagon made me redact. Because, and now we're getting back to why the redactions. I took my manuscript after I wrote it, and I took a deep breath. I felt like I was walking into the lion's den, and I knocked on the door of the Pentagon, and I sent the manuscript to the Pentagon. 4-month review. They sent it to all the intelligence agencies. There's a half a dozen or more of them. I'm not even sure I know all of them. There's so many little ones. But NSA, the big one, is the one that nobody heard of back then, pre-Edward Snowden. Post-Edward Snowden, everyone's heard of NSA. So I sent it to the Pentagon, and they did a 4-month review after sending it to all the intelligence agencies and required me to make redactions throughout the manuscript. And you'll see in my book, there's none that big, but there are other smaller ones throughout the book. And they did a very thorough job. Why did I even write a book? I'll tell you why. Because for years, I was troubled by the fact that we knew at the agency that Syria and Egypt were going to attack, definitely. I even knew the day that they were going to attack. The blank hits the fan on Saturday. Saturday was Yom Kippur that year. It bothered me that the Israeli soldiers that I was monitoring on the first day of the war didn't know. How could that be? They're our friends. They're our allies. We didn't share this definite intelligence with the Israelis? It troubled me. The excuse that I gave, giving the benefit of the doubt, as was my wont, was that somehow the intelligence got screwed up or delayed in transit. However, this still troubled me. And 7 years ago, I said the only person who could answer my troubling question is the then head of Israeli military intelligence, who was 89 years old, almost 90. And I said to myself, my God, no, I wasn't calling myself God. I said, my God, if I don't speak to him, how much longer is he going to be around? I may not get another chance. I called him up. He was very polite on the phone. Again, this is 45 years after the fact. He spoke to me very gentlemanly, and he invited me to his home because I told him that I was a Middle East intelligence analyst for NSA, and I have something to tell him. Really, I had something to ask him. He invited me to his home, and I said, both Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan said that they were in touch with foreign intelligence agencies that assured them that the Arabs had no plan to attack on or before October 6th. I asked Eli Zaira, General Eli Zaira, the head of Israel military intelligence, were these foreign intelligence friends the Americans? And he confided in me what I suspected, that yes. But I told him, this is crazy. You're sitting across the table from an intelligence analyst who was a Spec 4, not even a sergeant, who knew 2 days before that the Arabs were definitely going to attack. And you are telling me that you believe the Arabs were not going to attack because of an intelligence assessment that you received from the Americans. Something smells. How did he explain it? He explained it that I learned through a mutual friend of his and of mine that he thought I was lying. He thought I was making up a story. That's the only way he could explain it. He couldn't believe that the Americans would dupe Israel. So the generals, the American generals that he was in touch with, he wouldn't disclose to me who they were. But I asked him, apparently they duped you. And he said, no, they wouldn't dupe me. They were friends of Israel and they were loyal friends of Israel. They wouldn't have duped me. So I said to him, if they wouldn't have duped you, then they themselves would dupe. How could that be? These were the generals. Enter the Jew room. I learned of a cabal within NSA, back when I served there, that I didn't know at the time was called the Jew room. And John Loftus, an investigator and author of the book, The Secret War Against the Jews, which I recommend to anybody and everybody, writes about the Jew room because he interviewed members of the Jew room. But how did I discover it? Okay, first, why is it a misnomer? He says because Jews are not allowed entry, they're not even allowed to know that they exist. And it's not a singular room. It's multiple rooms. So how did I discover this back before I knew the name of it and back way before I read John Loftus's book and became friends with John Loftus? For some reason that I won't go into, I was transferred after the war into the Hebrew division. So now my good friend and my roommate became my supervisor. And he was a wonderful boss. And he arranged for a social event outside the agency for the department. There were about 30 of us, I would say. You know, maybe I'm disclosing a secret. I'm sorry. Sorry. I'm sure they're listening. There were a couple few dozen of us that went to this social event. One of the girls working as a Hebrew linguist got engaged to a Chinese American, and my friend, roommate, now supervisor, was an excellent linguist. In addition to Hebrew, he also knew Chinese, and he wanted an opportunity to speak Chinese with her fiance. So he arranged a get together in a restaurant bar. And one problem that he had, and his beer belly testified to it, He loved alcohol. And he got soused at this event. And we began doing something that's a big no-no. We were talking about agency work outside the agency. And he comes over to me at one point, and he, as the alcohol went in, the truth came out, and his good conscience bothered him. He comes over to me, and he takes his finger. I remember this like it was yesterday. He pokes it into my chest. He says, there are rooms in NSA that you can't get into because you're a Jew. So I knew that there were multiple rooms that I couldn't get into because I'm a Jew. So this is another fact. And 20 years after the Yom Kippur War, and now I'm a civilian, it bothered me so much that there existed this policy of maintaining rooms that are off limits to Americans with the highest security clearances because of their religion. So I wrote a letter to the head of security of NSA asking, does this policy still exist? Do you know what reply I got? No reply. So a year later, I wrote again. I said, I wrote you and I gave the date of the year before. And I asked, does the policy of maintaining rooms that are off limits to Jews, does it still exist? Same answer, non-answer. So this troubled me all these years. So after I met with Elie Zaira, I wrote up an op-ed disclosing what he disclosed to me, that he got intelligence assessments from the Americans. That was a false intelligence assessment that he relied on at the expense of 2,600 Israeli soldiers dead. And the important word is unnecessarily. And I take it to Haaretz, which is an Israeli, an esteemed, depending on from which political side you enter the equation from, esteemed daily Hebrew newspaper, kind of like the New York Times in both respects. And the editor read it and he said, Mr. Brill, this is explosive. Did you record him? I said, no. Did you have a witness? I said, no. He hands it back to me. He says, no one will believe you. So then people told me, you got to write a book. And that's what I did. I wrote this book. It's got a problematic title. My son gave it the title, Deceit of an Ally. Sounds un-American. But it's anything but un-American. It's un-un-American. What do I mean by that? It means that I'm writing this book against this un-American cabal that's embedded, or was embedded, in the intelligence agencies that work against not only Israel, they work against American policy. They're taxpayer-funded. They're unmonitorable, and they're working against American policy. If anyone knows Donald Trump, you got to get this book to Donald Trump. I don't know how to do it. But I think that his people need to know about this. Now, so I write the book. In writing the book, I went to my congressman. I was official residence, because I was living in Israel, in California at my son's address there. And I went to my congressman and I explained to him about this un-American cabal. And he said that he queried about it to his people in Washington, and their sources said that the Jew room had been disbanded. I said, that's fine. When was it disbanded? Because certainly in 1993, 94, it wasn't. And certainly when John Loftus's book came out in 96, it wasn't. See, what I'm saying is true. You sneezed. That means what I'm saying is true. It's a Jewish superstition. When was it disbanded? And if it was disbanded, what does that mean? It means that it existed, that I'm not making this up. And the second thing I said was to my California congressman, I'm from Missouri. You know what that means. Show me. Prove it to me. How can you prove it to me? How can anybody in the present White House administration know if the Jew Room is disbanded or not? How can you know? You can't walk into the agency without top security clearance. Even the president can walk in, but there are certain rooms that are off limits, even to people with top secret and above. You know, people think top secret. Oh, my God, top secret. My hands are shaking. The cleaning staff that walks into NSA needs a top secret clearance. So the analysts need a higher than top secret. Top secret is the lowest clearance, not the highest. So how can you know if the Jew Room has really been disbanded? I guess I should get back to flipping through. So you saw that my dad had two dog tags. During the Yom Kippur War, my unit, the Hebrew and Arabic linguists, were assigned. I was assigned to the 82nd Airborne because at that time it seemed like there might be a confrontation between the USSR and the USA at that time. So they needed linguists, Arabic linguists, to be assigned to American troops. And I was assigned to the 82nd Airborne. We were on red alert for periods of a couple few weeks that we couldn't go to the bathroom without calling into headquarters and letting them know that for 5 or 10 minutes we wouldn't be available. Red alert. And we were given all kinds of vaccinations and last will and testimony. Testament. I'm forgetting my English. I've been in Israel 46 years. I have an excuse to make mistakes in English. So they gave me another set of dog tags, too, that took Jewish off, and I became a Protestant. And I noticed this for the first time. I showed it to Gene. If you look at the top one, the number, my ID number is 083, and the bottom one, it's 082. So one of them is incorrect. The one on top is incorrect. So I guess I'm a Protestant. You want to hear a joke?
Sure.
I know this is serious, but maybe we'll break it up with a joke. When the war started leveling off and Israel wasn't in mortal danger anymore. In fact, Israel was making military advances on the West Bank of the Suez Canal. So I took the opportunity to be naughty again. You saw a couple instances I was naughty. Here too. I wrote a letter in my fledgling Hebrew to the Israel Minister of Defense, the one-eyed Moshe Dayan. And what I said was, I'm sending you a weapon because Israel, we understand, is in need of weapons resupply. And this weapon that I'm including in the package, I made him a sling, like a David and Goliath sling. That was one of my hobbies. I made like a half a dozen of them. And I got good at it. And what I learned is that you could get accurate and deadly. And it's like no wonder if you really use it and practice, this is a deadly weapon. And you could understand why David could kill a giant hitting him between the eyes. But wait a minute, let's have a little fun. I said the Bible says David hit Goliath between the eyes, but really he hit him between the legs. But this is not polite to mention in a holy book. I wish you the same luck with Sadat. Yeah, to have a little fun. So he writes me back a letter. Thank you for your, well, he also saw that my fledgling Hebrew was I was trying. Yeah, I said I'm an American soldier and blah, blah. So he says, thank you for your letter from the 18th of October. I enjoyed to read the letter written in our language of Hebrew. That's what he wrote me back. Nice, nice. Okay. And after I get the letter, like a week after, I get a letter from his secretary in English. Can you read what it says? I have been asked to acknowledge with thanks the receipt of the eye patch. A little bit of fun there. You know, and I'll spare you this. This is a what's called an eval, an evaluation report. And this one happens to be excellent. You can see E for excellent and O for outstanding. You want my autograph? I mean, this was written by someone whom I didn't work for. It was written by a man that I wish I could celebrate. He was an Air Force top sergeant. Let me explain why he wrote this outstanding eval for me. My immediate Arabic supervisor was I can't call him an anti-Semite because he liked Arabs, but he hated Jews. He was a Jew hater. And he wanted a socket to the resident Jew that he had in his unit. And he wrote the worst eval that could be imagined about me. It would have prevented me from continuing to work at NSA. It could have affected my future possibility to get jobs after my discharge from the Army. It was horrible. And middle management understood that this guy is socking it to the Jew boy. And so this Air Force sergeant, whom I want to celebrate, I have to blot out his name because the Pentagon requires me to blot out his name. He says that he has a higher government service rating than my immediate supervisor. So he could write this one and it would negate the bad one. And so there are good people that are not Jew haters that come to the Jew boys' rescue. And I got my honorable discharge and so forth and certificate of appreciation from the president and so forth. And this was a letter that I wrote to the security, the chief of security of NSA. I spoke about the letter of 1993. Here it is for you to see. I tried to be clean and good. And this was the letter from 94. How did I get actively interested in this subject? It happened because of Jonathan Pollard. Not directly, but I went to a demonstration outside the U.S. consulate on behalf of Jonathan Pollard. He was a Jew that was working in naval intelligence as a civilian, and I believe he was set up. He was obvious to me as an intelligence analyst in NSA that what they did to him, he was an easy setup. He's extremely intelligent. He's a walking encyclopedia of knowledge. He's very well spoken, but he's an easy setup from what I could see. And I believe that they set him up to entrap him. The same Jew room crowd. Okay, this is getting conspiratorial in how it sounds. But at the beginning, there were people on his behalf that were demonstrating outside the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem. And I went to listen. And I wasn't pro-Pollard at that time. I mean, the guy violated his secrecy oath. I took a secrecy oath. I didn't violate my secrecy oath. He violated his secrecy oath, that un-American pig. That's what I thought at that time. So I went to hear the demonstration, and a politician, Geula Cohen, got up on the stage, and she talked about that you can't rely on allies' intelligence assessments. You have to rely on your own. Wow, that's what I've been saying. So when she got off the stage, I told her my story briefly. She pushes me up on stage behind the microphone, and she said, tell your story. And I told my story. And there were reporters out in the audience, and they gathered around me, and they interviewed me, and I was invited to television. I was invited to radio. It was like I became a big deal. All I was doing is telling a story from 30 years before, more than 30 years before. And so I saw that there was an interest in this, and I began writing. And Jonathan Pollard's sister, Carol, contacted me and gave me a lot of information on his situation. And I read through it and then understood that he's not an American traitor. He's an American hero. And his supervisors were the traitors. And they should have been prosecuted. And so I wrote things to that effect and got published here and there. And this is just a sampling of my published work. And what is this? This is proof that American intelligence knew about the Syria and Egyptian attack before October 6th. This is proof. It was a CIA report. And this was counsel that Elie Zaira was in touch with, I don't know who, on this counsel. More corroboration. This is from Moshe Dayan. This is the Hebrew. 12 hours before, they, the Americans, said that their assessment is that the Arabs are not going to attack. 12 hours before, 2 days before, I knew they were going to attack. If the Arabs don't attack, they don't attack. What did we do? All the Russians, what's that word? Exited, and they advanced forces. And so we enlisted, readied our forces, but would not open fire. I don't think there should be severe recriminations toward us in such a situation. And if the Arabs would attack, we must assume that this will be a clear-cut case. We have a communications officer at each station. We must assure that whoever opens fire first will be on record. That is such garbage, because Elie Zaira believed they weren't going to attack and convinced Moshe Dayan and convinced Dado, the chief of staff, and convinced Golda Meir that there would be no attack. That's what he told me. And this guy becomes central in my book. When I began researching this whole thing, I went to used bookstores to get books on the Yom Kippur War. And in one of the bookstores, I meet this guy, tall fellow with a British accent and very distinguished. And he tells me that he was in charge of a contingency plan to do, guess what? To withdraw the boys from the Barlev Line. This is a line of fortifications along the Suez Canal to withdraw them on the 5th of October, the day before the attack was to begin, to withdraw them because they were sitting ducks, and everyone knew they were sitting ducks, to withdraw them and let the Arabs come across and then blow them to smithereens without losing one soldier, and two, without being seen, as Moshe Dayan was afraid, of firing the first shot. It wouldn't be, as Kissinger warned Golda Meir, do not do any preemptive strike. This is not a preemptive strike. You're withdrawing your forces. This was this contingency plan. Let them come across, and in place, you put high explosives, remotely detonatable. You let them come across and gather at the fortifications, blow them to smithereens. It was so simple, and it would require 24 hours to implement. Dani Ben Yaakov, I don't know if you want to hear this. I think I'm done. If you want to hear more, I can tell you about this, but it's in my book, the story about this fellow who is sitting in jail for the rape of a 14-year-old girl. What does that have to do with the Yom Kippur War? You'll get my book and you'll read. It's piquant. So I think it's time for Q&A. No questions? Okay, I'm going home.
What? I want to know what it has to do with it.
You want to hear about it?
Well, I want to know. I mean, you brought it up. You can't just leave me.
Okay. You heard of the movie Enemy of the State. Gene Hackman a few weeks ago passed away. Enemy of the State. He played the lead role. What was the name of the character that he played? Anybody remember? You're like me, I don't remember names, but I remember this name, Brill. Wait a minute, it's so obscure. I actually, in my book, I did a probability and statistic analysis. What's the likelihood of choosing the name Brill as a lead character in a record-breaking movie? Why choose a name like Brill? Maybe it's because I came out with my disclosures in 1994-95 when the screenplay of Enemy of the State was being written. And Brill in Enemy of the State was a retired NSA intelligence analyst. Could this be just coincidence? No, it can't be coincidence. So I wanted to find out, because I have a lawyer friend that says they obviously used your name in this money-making movie, and you should get a couple million out of it. So he said, do some research. And so I did some research. And it puts a smile on my face talking about something so sad and serious. I found out that the screenplay writer, David Marconi, if I remember the name right, or Marconi, was accused of stealing this script from this guy. And how did I find him? I found him. No. How do I go back? I'm a genius. I found this guy because I went to a screenwriter's page on the internet, and I find him accusing David Marconi of stealing the script from him. Because David Marconi was uncommunicative. He didn't want to talk about it. How did the name Brill wind up in this screenplay? So I contacted him. He's sitting in jail for rape of a 14-year-old in Missouri. I'm really not from Missouri, but he was living in Missouri. I think he's a Pakistani or Afghani or something. You can see by his last name, he's not, native-born American. But I contacted him, and I said, you claim that you wrote the screenplay. Can you explain to me why you chose the name Brill? He says, I don't remember exactly, but I didn't see Gene Hackman as playing the role of the lead character, but I did see Bruce Willis playing the lead role. So I took BR from Bruce and ILL from Willis, and I put them together and I got Brill out of it. Unbelievable, right? I mean, it beats any story you could make up, and it's true. Well, I was paranoid. I have a chapter or two in my book about being paranoid, and I'm still paranoid. I think I left the bottle. I'm going through VA exams and process to try and get disability benefits. And I went through some exams, and they did blood tests, and they found that I need a certain vitamin. And in the mail, I got a jar of folic acid pills to take one a day. And I didn't even open the jar because I'm paranoid that there could be, I'm probably mistaken, but it could be that they want to do away with me. So I didn't even open the jar. I'm not going to take any, and I'm not going to give it to any friends. Maybe I'll give it to an enemy and see what happens. But yeah, I was paranoid. But after I sent it to the Pentagon and after it went through their review, not only did it go through their review once, and that took 4 months. This is another story. You want to hear another story?
Of course.
Of course. Whew. After I got their approval, under the two conditions, one, that I redact what they require redacted, and two, that I don't add one additional word of content, which is reasonable. But after that, then this Moshe Dayan I don't have it here, but he came out that the Americans, well, you saw, I wanted to include that in my book, that the Americans gave him and said 12 hours before the attack began that the Arabs are not going to attack. So I wanted to include that in my book. That was number one. Number two, I interviewed Pfefferman. He was like a lieutenant in intelligence, an Arabic linguist that was monitoring Syrian communications, live communications. And there were three distinct indications that there would be an attack the following day, without a doubt. And he sent it on to headquarters, which is called Amman. It has nothing to do with Jordan's capital. It's, again, even in the Israeli army, they have acronyms. So Amman is the intelligence. He sent them on to the headquarters of Amman that tomorrow there's going to be an attack. But the head of the military intelligence of Israel ignored that. So I wanted to include that in my book. That was number two. Number three, my sister, who didn't marry my good friend, roommate, supervisor, married someone else and got divorced and is single now and looking for someone. She went on a dating site in Israel. And there's this fellow who stands about 6'4", maybe 5", And of course, he's from Texas. And he's on the same dating site. And I meet him at my sister's place. And we get talking. Hey, you were in the Army. Yeah, I was too. When did you enlist? 71. Me too. When did you get out? 74. Me too. Where did you serve? USASA. Me too. Who did you work for? NSA. Me too. He served in NSA in Europe, and in early October 73, after these false alarms that were ignored, in early October, they were not ignored. He knew already days before I did. His unit was restationed from somewhere in Germany, and I was Pentagon required, I don't disclose, to another site in Italy, and I can't tell you. I can say because they told me not to disclose, but the truth is I don't remember. And they knew that there would be a war beginning on October 6th. And he asked his supervisor, we're relaying this to the Israelis. And his supervisor said, it's not your job to ask. And he was troubled by that. And during the war, he asked again, are we passing our raw intelligence on to the Israelis, our friends? And again, he got the same answer, and he was troubled by it. And he's not Jewish. He's not Jewish, I lied. He was not Jewish. He was so troubled by it that when he got out of the service, he eventually converted to Judaism, and he moved to Israel. And are you all sitting down? He renounced his American citizenship. And so I wanted to share his story. So that was the third thing. So I went back to the Pentagon and sent it again. And it was an additional two-month review. So this book has the unique distinction of being reviewed and approved twice by the Pentagon. Thank you so much.
Thank you for telling us another story.